Following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. I am your host, Dave Littlejohn, and joining me, as always,
Matt Dixon.
Right, I think I can say, as always, at this point, you're pretty much here most of the time.
If I'm not here, the world has probably ended, or...
If I'm not here, I'm somewhere else.
It's a black hole that we've entered into, something like that.
That, or you're fishing.
Yeah. That would be a good use of time.
It's like, I have to think this through. Should I be here or should I be fishing?
You know, rarely do you ever, like, have remorse for going fishing, unless, like, you sink your boat or something. That'd be a rough day.
I suppose. I am such a terrible fisherman that I don't know. It doesn't register the same for me. Right? I have to go with somebody that's great at fishing to just sort of, like, training wheels through the whole thing.
You know, some of the best fishing trips, though, are the ones where there's no one around and you don't talk to anyone all day and the only thing you hear are the birds chirping.
Okay.
Those are some of the best days because then you can just totally relax. You don't have to carry a conversation. You're just out there enjoying the sunshine, catching fish.
Matt, if you're on the radio and you're like, I just don't like carrying a conversation... That.
Well, think about it. What do we do as financial advisors? We're always in front of people, or we're on the radio. We're always talking. We're always engaged. Sometimes it's nice to just not be engaged at all. Shut the mind off.
And fishing is shutting the mind off?
It is, yeah.
There's a bunch of fishermen right now that are like, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is a very intellectual sport here. You got to outsmart the fish.
Well, maybe that's what it is.
And then there's a handful of us that are like, I thought fish like didn't even have brains. They just kind of react however they react.
Yeah. So we need to get you out there, get you some fresh steelhead for dinner.
Well, you know, I enjoy going out with the right people, but that's kind of like my story for most things is a lot of it is what's the sort of the social backdrop of what I'm involved in. Because I don't have anything against fishing, but I just don't go out and fish on my own because, one, I'm not terribly great at it. Two, when you don't know what you're doing, you feel a little bit lost at it. And three, the payoff for fishing in and of itself isn't that great for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the folks that really love it, like, well, okay. But I could think of other things that would be sort of a therapeutic use of time. So
I really like it when someone comes into the office that I haven't met, like a prospect or something, and they're like a big fisherman because then I can just sit there for like a solid 30 minutes and all we do is just chat about fishing and it's so great. So if you're one of those people out there who is like, hey, I need a financial advisor, but I really just want to talk about fishing, we might be a good
combo. And it
turns
out, I mean, if we think about the things that you're into some interesting things and they're really different than me, which is kind of wild. So the fishing thing, Matt is a good fisherman, by the way. He's good at this. But what are some of the other kind of random ones?
I like shooting trap.
Yeah, shooting. You love hunting, right?
Love
I mean, that's
hunt.
Always a thing where you can get out and and so.
Ooh, woodworking. I like to build stuff.
Oh,
over the weekend, I built rubber band guns for me and the kid and the wife, too. And so we're going to be having some rubber band wars.
What
built
could go
some
wrong?
Forts.
Yeah. Nice.
Wear your safety goggles. Let's.
Well, all right. Then you're good.
Yeah.
Like, how much damage can you do as long as your eyes are protected with a rubber band gun?
I gave him one of the. He actually helped me build it. He's pretty good at that.
He was
running the drill, doing some sanding at 2.5.
Course.
Yeah.
Of course.
He even got a chance to run the chop saw the other day. Now, was that a good move?
Adult supervision, so we're clear.
No one called Child Protective Services here. He was fully supervised. So he runs all the power tools, and he knows that they can hurt him, too. We talk about that.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's a big deal.
It is.
You know, it's not ever been, although actually, I don't know. My daughters might be into something like that. I haven't done a ton of woodworking, mostly because of sort of space and whatnot. But it's still interesting. I actually, you know, the process sounds therapeutic. It's just how often do you carve the time out to do it?
Justin was heckling me about it earlier at the office. He's like, you spent half a day to make a $7 item. I'm like, yeah, I did. But at the same time, it's going to be one of those things where it's like when you look at it, you're like, I made that. That's kind of
well,
cool.
But remember, we've talked about this before. Why is it okay to do that as opposed to just buy the item?
It's because it charges your batteries up, right?
Like, right.
I spent like $18 to buy one piece of wood. Go figure that wood's gone up that much. But it was like $18 for a board. And I'm like, gosh dang it, I could have bought it cheaper. But I built it with quality. It's not going to fall apart. It's not going to break. And if it does break, well, it's going to be an easy fix. So
plus, it's the therapy benefit.
It was.
Right?
That was the big part I meant
to get
to. I
tell people a lot, I don't mow my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
But some folks love mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
It, like, to them, it's just that the when it's over and they see that, you know, the lines are great and they've the edges are perfect. And it's just there's this real sense of sort of accomplishment and pride. And it's like, yeah, look at that lawn. That's awesome.
I did that. I did that with the camp trailer. Did you ever see that? I built like a little camp trailer and we camped out of that thing for like, I don't know, 6 years.
Just saw pictures of it. You told me about it.
And I sold it because the family's grown, right? And now I'm at this crossroads where I don't have a ton of time to build another one. But the thought of like buying something that I didn't build and like, because when I take it to a campground, you know, I'd get a bunch of compliments and that felt good. And now it's like, do I really want to go buy some leaky thing that sucks? No, I want to build it, but then I don't have time to build it. So it's like, ah. So I haven't done anything. Still don't have a camp trailer.
Well, okay. So that's the kind of thing where I would probably make the build-buy trade-off personally.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get stuck in a crossroads. And I feel like people do that with their finances too, right? Like they want to manage it themselves. And then they're like, well, maybe I should hire someone. And then they just sit there and they take no action because they're kind of stuck in the in-between.
To me, that's probably the number one reason out there, like, why do people hire advisors in the first place? It's because it doesn't happen otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? That's the biggest reason, is it just doesn't happen. I don't know how many times I've had to say this, but I'll say it one more. It's not that your advisor is more intelligent than you are and more capable. What they are is more experienced and specialized, typically. Right? They have a different set of tools, and this is the job to do it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest, you know, I could do my own landscaping, right? But here's the crazy thing. I don't currently own a lawnmower. Makes it pretty hard to mow the lawn if you don't own a lawnmower, right? We have a service that takes care of it. I'm super glad that we do. It's time in my life that I've reclaimed so that I can use it elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that's the best to me.
Yeah.
To me, right? But could I mow the lawn? Yeah. I mean, I mowed a
bunch of lawns. There's also a cost associated with that, right? Like you have to buy the lawnmower. You have to sometimes replace spark plugs. And then, oh, now you need a leaf blower. And, oh, now you need a rake. And now you need all these other tools. And then you got to store them.
The biggest thing for me is the time trade.
Yeah.
That's the single biggest thing because I have a lot of moving parts as a business owner and a boss and an advisor. It's just, there's a lot of moving parts, right? And I still want to be involved in my children's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be able to be a participating dad. I do some volunteer coaching. There's a lot of stuff that's fun for me to do that isn't mowing the lawn. So you're reclaiming time. And this is one of those that it's really hard. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this over the years, is there's this progression in life where you go from first, You do a lot of things DIY because your time and your money go farther when you do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
As your skill set begins to scale and you become more valuable to the marketplace, and that doesn't automatically happen, just so you're aware. Like just getting older and doing the same job over and over doesn't make you more valuable to the marketplace. But typically with experience and knowledge comes more marketplace value, so you get paid more. And so then you start to do different calculus for what you do and don't do.
Right.
And other things compete for your time. And so you start to trade by buying time back when you're outsourcing for other things.
That's fair.
Right? And then as you go up the echelon of that trade, you stop thinking about it directly in terms of time trade, and it starts becoming value trade. So you make decisions about what is more valuable for me, doing this thing with my time or doing a different thing with my time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are, again, as you kind of ascend the income ladder, those are the way the decisions evolve. Where some folks get stuck is they don't necessarily understand how the decisions are getting made in the first place, or maybe worse than that, they don't bother to look at what they don't even care about the decision, right? They allow the decision to be reactive and just happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the, if there was one significant mistake financially that people make, it is being reactive to decisions in their lives.
Yeah. Reactive to decisions, or they just jump the pace, right? Like how many people like are out there and they barely make enough money to scrape by, but they do have the landscaper. You know what I mean? Where they actually can't afford it. You're in a situation where you can afford it, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some people, and I've witnessed this, where it's like, you know, oh, you pay someone to go clean up your dog poop, right? And it's like, that's a real service that people are paying for, but they're massively in debt or something. And it's like, no, like, go clean it up yourself. And
this is the one that's really tough, too. It's not going to be popular for me to say this, right? I do not say this out of meanness either. But what about the people that insist on having pets and they can't even afford the pet? They
Ooh,
can't
yeah.
afford themselves, but they have a pet.
Mm-hmm.
And you will try to say, well, you know, it's emotional support or this, that, and the other. I get that you love your pet and you want to rationalize having the pet. But if you can't afford the pet, that's a problem.
Yep.
And so what I would suggest is rather than viewing that through the lens of you're telling me I can't have a pet. No, what I'm telling you is we need to figure out a way to get you more valuable in the marketplace so that you can afford the pet. That's
True.
Really what I'm saying. It's like, if you want a pet, let's make sure you're in a spot where you can have one. But that means making decisions that are less reactive and more intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, well, and there you have it, folks. We've now started down the path of how we're going to parse out decisions today. So we're going to talk more about this, the idea of reactive versus proactive in decision making and how this plays out in your finances and in other areas of your life categorically, because it's connected to all of it. But I can't believe it. We already got to take a break. So
okay.
I'm looking at the clock. We'll do that. When we come back, we'll explore more. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay, reminder, grab the podcast. I always make this reminder at the first break that you can catch up if you don't know what we've been talking about. Go to littlejohnfs.com. That's our webpage. Under the Knowledge Center, you'll see a drop down, and there's podcasts and blog and there's other stuff. All and a bunch of free tools. So, you know, I think everybody's peddling their own version of free tool. Why do we do it? I guess we want you to come to our webpage. I don't know. It makes me feel good. Whatever. So we're talking about proactive versus reactive decisions. It really has morphed a little bit because we talked about all kinds of stuff. Like, what should we cover on the show today? But what's not lost on me, Matt, is I think what we're talking about for a lot of the people that listen to this show, it's not going to resonate other than you just to agree. Because most of the people, I think, listening to the show, if you're interested in financial topics, you're like, oh, well, I'm going to listen. Then you're probably not like the typical consumer out there. You're doing some things with intention already, including listening
to
the
probably,
show.
You're probably doing some things right.
Yeah. And so I don't want to get into the
all the
scenario.
Things you could do wrong.
Well, yeah, we're just talking about all the things you could do wrong, blah, 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 blah. But you said something during the break that just kind of struck me that's really fascinating. And I actually think financial advisors can be extraordinarily useful for this.
Oh, man. I don't even remember what I said. So refresh my memory.
Well, the way you said it, and the reason I think I'm calling this out is we take it for granted as advisors.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to get on the show and talk to people with bad behavior and say, hey, you know, don't do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
But what I notice a lot of the time is we have folks that in retirement struggle to give themselves permission to do certain things.
Oh,
and we find ourselves saying, hey, you do know that you can afford to do this thing.
Yeah.
And they're sort of shocked almost like, are you serious? Like,
I've literally had to tell two different people over the years, you know what? For the best interest of your financial plan, I actually think you should buy a vacation house. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, like looking at everything that you've got going on, there's some potentially like really beneficial tax reasons for you to be in another state. And I know you want to move and you want to travel. And if you already want to do those things and we start looking at your financial plan, it actually pencils where you could have more money in retirement by living there. So yeah, go ahead and keep your house here and go buy another house in Florida or Nevada or wherever
it might be. And this one, by the way, this one's a toughie. I know sometimes I rant about this, but I don't want this to be a rant day. That's not where I'm going with this. It's easy to start to throw rocks at our local tax policy when you compare what are we doing in Oregon to what other states are doing, and then look at it's fiscally problematic. I don't know what else to call it, right? We have a high tax rate. It never seems to be enough. And
a high cost of living.
And a high cost of living. And so, but what happens is the folks that have the ability that are paying the most in taxes, they're the ones that have the ability to leave.
Yep.
And so when you start to develop these tax policies that become sort of penalties for sticking around, it makes the decisions uncomfortable for folks that really do love the Pacific Northwest. They really do love Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost as if they're being told, well, if you want to stay, we're going to make you pay for it.
Yeah.
And not like you're going to pay for it like everybody chips into the kitty. I mean, like, you're going to disproportionately be tagged for this stuff. And, you know, when folks try to say, well, you know, everybody's paying for this tax or that tax or the other tax, I would suggest, I don't know that that's really true, because if it made sense, it'd be easier for people to stay. Mm-hmm. I think people that stay do so because they love this place so much that they're willing to tolerate the things that are out of whack. It's mm-hmm. not because the things are working. It's because it's that beautiful here.
Yeah.
And folks want to be here and they're willing to pay to stay. That's what happens.
Yeah.
But you're right that oftentimes it is cheaper to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really is. And I guess my caution to legislators is this isn't a partisan thing. This is a get real thing, that you don't want to penalize things that are working.
Well, look at a company like Dutch Bros.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
great
they
example.
Were what,
homegrown the, talent and it leaves.
Yeah. And I think it was the third largest business in Oregon. And they just got tired of the corporate taxes. And they're like, well, why be here if we can just go headquarter in Arizona?
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, we'll keep all of our stores running, you know, but we're just going to go somewhere else and set up shop. And it's like, well, there goes how many millions of dollars in revenue for the state because you want to be ultra greedy?
I don't even know if it's ultra greedy. I think that sometimes there's just a certain naivety about how finances work at a grassroots level,
mm-hmm.
right? There's this idea that, no, we'll all kind of chip in. And so this idea that you're making a decision for the entire group, but the reality is not every decision works that way. Maybe it's supposed to be applied to everybody in the group, mm-hmm. but only a small percentage in the group bear the cost.
Yeah.
And they see it. And if it's what happens when that revenue ceases to be a great investment for the people that are paying it? That's the real issue that we deal with here. You can appeal to the masses and say, we're going to create a thing that's only going to tax a handful of people. And it works for a little while until it doesn't. And if those people leave, then what?
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue, is people can vote with their feet. So I just, and that's not partisan.
No. Nope.
That's just an economics issue.
Absolutely.
So anyway, off of the high horse of, you know, knocking policy and back to the nuts and bolts of it is, I still see a lot of people that make good financial decisions and then they find themselves unwilling to maybe spend. This is a real thing. Folks that have become cultural savers.
Oh yeah.
And they struggle to spend.
And sometimes they'll even struggle to spend at the expense of like costing themselves more money.
Yes.
You know?
Because save themselves into less money.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen scenarios where folks accumulate, and then it ends up in an estate tax environment.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a classic one.
You know what estate tax is another thing to call it, death tax.
Yep.
You have stuff and you die with it. And then the state ends up with that stuff where you could potentially gift a lot of that stuff away and not have it be taxed. There are a lot of strategies that involve just moving the chips around on the board,
mm-hmm.
right? You just rearrange the pieces and it can help to reduce your taxes. That's the kind of stuff that planners are great for.
Right.
If you don't understand how that works, that's, you know, it's not just hiring an investment person. I think that's probably the biggest misnomer out there. I got my investment person. I would say investment guy, but you know, it's a lot of investment gals too. And so, yeah, I got my investment person. Okay, what else are they doing? Because my guess is most of them are at least trying to do a lot more than just manage investments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the issue here. Is I don't know about you, Matt, but I feel like the investments, while it's important, and it's certainly something that we put time into, it is just a piece of a much more comprehensive puzzle that's a lot bigger.
Yeah, do you want to talk to the people a little bit about, because I think it's kind of a black box for a lot of people. They know that you manage money, right? You go pick some stocks and you do that part. Do you want to talk a little bit about what are some of the other things that someone can expect when hiring a professional?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. First thing is, by the way, I'd be surprised most investment pros, they don't even pick stocks anymore. Most folks at a retail level
mm-hmm.
are picking mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, or they're farming it out to third parties that are
managing.
That's
a good point to bring up, yeah. Yeah, is the person that you're paying actually picking investments, or do they sub that out?
Right, and keep in mind, you may be with an organization that has more of a household brand name. I'm not going to use any on air because I don't want to get into that, picking one over the other.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've got Brand X, and Brand X has their team of people that they can put you in, and they will manage this for you. Well, that's still outsourcing. It's just outsourcing inside of their own organization.
Correct.
So how do you know if it's being outsourced? Kind of track the number of layers of fees associated. Mm-hmm. How many middlemen are involved in the arrangement?
Well,
or how many subcontractors? This is probably a better way to describe it than middleman. But how many subcontractors are going to get a layer of fees?
That's an interesting point you bring up, because a lot of these places, and I've heard this from a lot of people lately, you know, Matt, I really liked meeting with you because the pricing was transparent, and I went to this XYZ company and they couldn't give me a straight answer on what I was going to be paying for. And I think it's because of what you just said. There were so many different layers of fees that they didn't even want to touch the hot stove because they'd have to disclose, you know, oh, there's six layers of fees here.
Dare we discuss this? Do we actually just come right out and try to unlock that black box a little bit?
I think we owe it to our listeners, because they're wondering, like, what can the potential layers of fees be? And if they have that information, then they can go out, shop it themselves, and make educated choices.
All right, well, let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We're going to unpack some of the concepts behind fees. What I'm going to tell you right now is you're probably not going to like all of it, not because it's not transparent, but because you're going to discover it's still murky. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show, where we open Pandora's box today.
Yeah.
Matt, we, you know why? So just so everybody knows, at the break, we were talking about fees and how it's really difficult to know what you're paying for in the financial services industry. And some of that, I think, is intentional, but some of it is not. And so we are going to try to talk about that. We don't talk about it on the show a lot, mostly because it's complicated. And also because I'm just going to come right out and say it. For a bunch of people, I think they have been trained to look at fees and equate them with investment success. Like if I can find the lowest fee possible, then it will automatically mean I'm the most successful. And there are some fundamental assumptions that I take issue with. The first of which is, I don't know that we can guarantee that all investments are created equal, right? The assumption that, well, if all investments are created equal, then the cheapest one will carry you the farthest. And I would say, okay, mathematically true. Now, are they all equal? And it's like, well, if you're buying, if you're just buying an S&P index, something like that, then in theory, they should all be the same and you can just get the cheapest one.
Right.
But even then, the theory is not necessarily perfectly straightforward.
Do explain.
Well, for the most part, an S&P 500 fund is an S&P 500 fund. I think that that's pretty accurate. Like they're probably 98% the same. What happens if you run into a liquidity issue where you happen to choose a provider that has less trading than another? Then you could actually have a trading efficiency gap. You could potentially have a small timing gap on a rebalancing date, something like that. Yeah. And there are things that they're subtle, but those little differences, you know, there's a reason that we say investing in an index is only theoretical. Right? You can't actually own an index because an index has no cost associated with it. And to get an index, there is a cost. Right? You have to obtain the positions somehow in order to have this index. And there's a cost to get them from the system into your account one way or another.
Yeah. And it's even if you look at some of these index funds, they hold a lot different weightings underneath the hood between different companies, right? Like,
well, in theory, an S&P 500 index, there's a formula they're supposed to follow it, right? In order to be the fund, it should be sort of the same whether you get it from Vanguard or you get it from iShares or you get it from Barclays, wherever you get them from, right? They should be the same. But in practice, especially on the mutual fund side, they're not perfectly the same because there's different expense ratios and little subtle things about, you know, the management of the fund.
Yeah.
Again, I think that they're nominal enough that we could dismiss them as rounding errors, but it's all part of why this is a more complex discussion. Because the first thing I'm going to ask you is, do you know what you're even paying for? What do the fees go towards? Because oftentimes the fee covers a list of items and the list isn't the same, right? If you're buying from Company A versus Company B, you may be paying the same amount but buying a different service level.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? I mean, what if one company says, well, you're buying money management from us, and but we have transaction
planning,
fees. Another company says, well, you're buying money management from us, and we absorb the transaction
fees. Now that you
fees.
Mention it, I have seen that actually, you know, a good handful of times when reviewing someone's statement, and it's like, technology fees, and I'm like, what is this? You know, like, what's the technology fee for? And it doesn't really say.
Yeah, or an annual account fee. Does that exist or not? Right?
Yeah.
So those are interesting. You're paying these little ancillary fees on top of it.
Trading fees.
Record keeping. You know, those can be different elements.
Yeah.
Here's a really interesting one. When you own mutual funds, do you have any idea what the trading costs are?
You're saying outside of just like what the mutual fund fee is, you're like, was there a cost to get you into it or get you out of it?
I'm saying if you have a mutual fund, the manager is buying and selling things inside of the fund, especially if it's actively traded. Any idea what the trading costs are?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
The answer is they're not published because you don't know what they are until after they occur. So the investor receives the return net of the trading costs.
Right.
And yet oftentimes people are evaluating what they're spending on something and they'll look at trading costs from their existing provider. Right. And the question is, can you even see all the fees?
Right.
A lot of people don't know what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to discern, well, what is in here? Because I can tell you right now, if you go look at a mutual fund, look at the turnover ratio.
Mm-hmm.
That is a reportable event that says, well, how often are the stocks being bought or sold inside of this strategy? Because there are costs associated with the trades. You just can't see them. Yeah. So very high turnover ratio could lead to enhanced performance if they're doing a great job, could lead to higher expenses that you don't see. You kind of have to discern what you're looking at when you're breaking this apart. That's why, again, the fee conversation is complicated because, well, which part of the fee are we going to look at?
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of folks see today, hey, I'm going to a broker and they tell me there's no fee at all. It's built into what I'm buying. I mean, I've heard that, right?
Yeah.
No, we don't charge any fees. It's just, you know, the mutual fund pays us. Okay, then the mutual fund charged the fee,
mm-hmm.
and they rebated it back. It's not a rebate. It's called a commission in this case. But that's how the salesperson was compensated, is you bought the thing, and then the thing paid the salesperson.
Wait, so you're saying there's no such thing as free lunch?
I haven't found a free lunch yet.
Dang.
I know. The economic theory holds true.
Yeah, when you find it, you let me know.
Right. I mean, I've seen people donate lunches before and mm-hmm. they bore the cost, so you didn't, so it looked free to you, but somebody paid for it.
Right.
So yeah.
I think there's a lot of people out there that really do think that there is free lunch. And that's why I say that, right? Like they're like, yeah. Well, surely it's free, right? I mean, I'm not really paying anything out of my own pocket, and it's like,
yeah, what I think where people miss is free versus free to me. Appears free to me,
mm-hmm.
and you call it free, doesn't mean it was free, because we don't actually have the same definition.
Right. Yeah, your gross returns were 11% and you netted 9. It's like, okay, well, you had a 2% fee. You just didn't directly pay it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing, is if I don't know I paid it, then did it not count?
I don't know.
So
did the tree fall in the woods if you didn't hear it? It's like,
well, if you come back and see it down, I guess it fell, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, these are the sort of age-old questions that come up a lot. But let's just kind of name some of the layers of fees. And I think you have to start out with understand there's two primary types of let's talk about your personal representative, whether you have a broker or an advisor. They're not the same thing legally. Okay,
right.
So let's start with the concept of a broker. Most traditional would be think of like a stockbroker.
Mm-hmm.
If they buy or sell something on your behalf, they get a commission for the transaction.
Right.
This is also a model that doesn't exist very often any longer. Right. It's still out there, but less frequently, specifically because of something called churning. You heard this term before, right?
Yeah, because what if, you know, you're getting paid on those transactions and then every day you go trade 20 times in a person's account and you're getting tons and tons of commissions? Well,
yeah,
that could be.
One of the ways that was mitigated was you didn't get to trade without permission.
Mm-hmm.
The client had to authorize every transaction. Okay, well, now you have a timeliness issue, right? Because now you have to actually connect, agree on a transaction, and then to go execute it.
Right.
So you
and imagine
time
you have 1,200
delays.
Clients, and then it's like, I want to sell Apple today. I got to
call 1,200 people.
That's inefficient. Yeah.
Sounds like a challenge.
Right.
So yeah, it created lots of different issues. But nevertheless, that was a very traditional model. Is if they bought or sold something for you, they got paid for the transaction. It was a commissionable event.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen a lot of evolution in the industry. And that's why what I want to point out is the broker model, while it still exists, and you still see it a lot in things like insurance.
Okay.
Okay. Insurance is pretty straightforward because there's not a lot of churn to insurance. You buy it, it runs for its term, and then it renews, and then you can buy something different if you want to, right? You tend to buy car insurance in anywhere from 1 to 12 month increments. And so you can shop around and change if you want to, but you kind of pay as you go. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're going to have somebody shopping your, in fact, insurance is an interesting one because if you buy it and you don't use it for a stated period of time, they typically rebate back the unused portion of premium.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's, you're far less likely to have a churning problem in that kind of industry. And so it still tends to exist. Somebody sells you life insurance, there's a commission associated. That's just kind of the way the model works. It's not bad. It's just how it is.
Yeah.
So, but in the investment world, the problem was, what happens when people hop from investment to investment? Are they doing it because it was in the best interest of their client? Or are they doing it because it generates revenue for them?
Mm.
That was an issue. And
well,
so
that could be especially, you know, kind of dangerous if it's an account where, you know, a sale triggers a taxable event. You know, in an IRA, kind of big whoop-de-doo. But if that's like a brokerage account and then there's...
Well, I think it's still a big whoop-de-doo, though, if you consider, what if you're getting about 4% of the transaction? So
that's
I bought
true.
Something
that's
and
true.
Then three yeah. weeks later, I said, well, let's sell this and buy something else. And they get a fresh commission.
Right. It's just kind of draining the portfolio slowly.
Yes.
It's like a slow bleed.
There were even some reports, and granted, this is probably 15, 20 years ago, but there were concerns about things that were happening at some of the larger firms. They called it velocity ratio. It was the idea that they were breaking trades apart into smaller lots because they could sell pieces of them and do multiple transactions inside of it. And the company made money not just on the sale from the customer, but on the individual pieces internally because they had their own inventory that they could trade in and out of their own inventory.
So were they using
well
the spread on the buy versus
yes.
the sell to
yes.
then like, ooh.
Yeah, so that was part of what was going on is they were managing that. So they had the velocity ratio was a higher amount. And so they were ending up making a fair amount of money just on the customer account within their ecosystem.
Fractions of pennies over millions of shares over 365 days out of a year. It's like, well, that can add up.
Well, nevertheless,
especially when you're managing billions.
Much of this has been squashed.
Sure.
Okay. It's been squashed because there's been a significant trend toward the advisory side of the business. It looks different, but you still need to know about it. If you want to learn, you have to stick around. I have to take our last break.
You don't want to just skip the commercial?
And... I would do it, but we have to keep the lights on. So
okay.
stick around. If you want to understand how did advisory begin to solve the problem of churning, we will explain that and what exactly the fees look like when we come back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got Truewell on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Home stretch, gang. Welcome back to the Truewell Show. So, Matt.
Yeah.
We're packing the black box, and I don't know if we're helping or we're confusing it more, but fee structure. We're talking about the old stockbroker model of kind of pay as you go and pay commissions
mm-hmm.
and some of the problems that were associated with that. It doesn't mean that they were always problems. There were plenty of really honorable practitioners in the world, but not all.
Sure.
And so the industry wanted to figure out
what
to do.
There's always a few bad eggs in the mix, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And what we've seen now is a real gravitation towards the advisory marketplace. Now, advisors do not get compensated based on what is sold. They get compensated based on the
kind of how much
the
money
management
there is to bill
of,
on, yeah.
of the providing of advice. Here's what's interesting, right? And full disclosure, this is the model that our firm uses. Okay. Imagine that a customer comes in, they have a retirement account and they've saved $1 million and they would hire us. And I'm going to use like really simple numbers just because it makes the math really straightforward, right? They would come in and say, well, I want help managing $1 million so that it lasts the rest of my life. And we would say, okay, well, there's a money management need for the $1 million. It needs investment decisions associated with it. We're not going to get compensated for what we choose to buy or sell. We're going to get compensated for trying to fulfill the mission for the client. And maybe they say, I don't want to outlive my money. So this needs to be able to pay me for as long as I'm going to be around. And we also need to manage some taxes. And so we look at comprehensive financial strategy. Great. Well, what other assets do you have in your life? And we develop an entire financial plan. And so the fee for managing that money also includes the planning, the strategy, the tax awareness, the estate awareness, all of the other things that come with that picture. And so if you think to yourself, well, what's the fee? And so, well, let's just keep it easy. Let's say we're going to charge 1%. And you go, 1% of $1 million, that's like $10,000. Like, it is. Now, what does that $10,000 buy? It buys all of the money management. It buys all of the estate planning time. It buys all of the research time. It buys all of the staff time. It buys all of the software, all of the insurance. It buys all of the comprehensive stuff. And it comes out of the account, typically. Mm-hmm. And the account typically is earning somewhere between 8 and 12%. So, the account's going to make between $80,000 and $120,000. So the idea is that you have a fiduciary. Love the F word on the radio, right? Fiduciary has a legal obligation to put the client's needs first, unlike a broker. The fiduciary doesn't get paid more or less for what they buy or sell or don't buy or don't sell. They're paid for the outcome, mm-hmm. right? To make sure the $1 million sticks around. In fact, if they want a raise, if they're getting a percentage, grow the account.
Right.
Make it bigger. And then...
then the interests then, are kind of aligned.
So the interests do stay aligned. And if you make bad decisions and the account shrinks, they get paid less. Now, why would you only pay if you make money? Well, that's probably dangerous. Because now what you've done is said, well, since you have to make me money or I won't pay you, how am I going to keep you from taking stupid risks? Why mm-hmm. not just swing for the fences every single time? Because if you miss, you're not going to get paid anyway. So you may as well try to hit for the fences. Well, that's not a very good strategy to stay retired. If all you're going to do is be super aggressive with your investments, and if you're wrong, you're unretired because you lose money. So you don't want to do that. You want to stay aligned and you want all of the aspects managed.
Yeah.
Well, that's the difference between a comprehensive fee and just a money management fee. It's also why if you go to certain outfits, they would say, oh, sure, you can get it for cheap. Maybe you can get it for a fraction of a percent. Maybe it's 30 basis points, which is 0.3%.
Yeah.
Like 100 basis points is 1%. You can get it for half of that, 50 basis points. You go, great. What comes with that? And the answer is, oh, well, you'll get the investments managed and we'll do quarterly rebalancing and we'll do an annual call to make sure that you're still aligned with your risk. So what about taxes? Nope, don't do that. What about estate planning? Nope, don't do that. What about financial planning? Oh, we'll do that for another fee, mm-hmm. right? You can hire one of our people and we'll bill you X thousands of dollars for that too. Right? It's cheaper because there's more services that are a la carte. That's why it's so hard to have the fee discussion. Because what am I buying?
Right. Yeah.
What am I buying? And so when you talk to an advisor, ask them these questions. This is one of them that you can ask. What's your service level agreement?
That's
like,
a good
remember
way to say
that
it, yeah.
phrase. What's your service level agreement? The idea is, what services are you committing to provide me at this price? What mm-hmm. should I be able to expect from you?
Yeah.
And they should be able to articulate that to you.
Yeah. And then are there any third-party fees? That's, I think, one that you might ask.
That's a biggie because, yeah, what fees should I expect in addition to your fee?
To your fee. That's the kicker that I see a lot of people, they don't ask that. And then it's like, well, they didn't lie when they told you what their fee was, but what they didn't include was all the other fees that...
Right. And here's where it can get sneaky, too, because what we call the fee matters. There's a difference between a commission mm-hmm. and a transaction.
Yeah.
If you've never heard that, like the difference between commission and transaction. There's also things like separate account management fees. There's operating expenses. If you look the expense ratio, which is the way to say, well, what's the fees built into the investment itself? So if you own a mutual fund, the mutual fund has a fee. Mm-hmm. Even no-load mutual funds have fees associated, just so you're aware. It just means they don't have commissions built into them. but they still have operating costs.
Right, because so the fund manager still wanting to get paid.
Yeah, what are the operating costs? What are the transaction fees? Are there any commissions associated with it? What are the advisory fees? Are there any other technology fees? You could just say, like, what's the list of fees associated? Because what you're really trying to get is, what's the all-in cost? And keep in mind that most people can't tell you what the transactions will fully cost. Some will say, oh, the transactions are free.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, if something is free, it's being paid for somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, oh, they're free. However, you have to put the money in a certain money market account because they're going to use that money for their banking program in order to provide, you know, these other things. They're offsetting the cost somewhere else is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you're right. There really is no free lunch. But
No. The
better we can understand the total fee package, the better we can, you know, try to figure out what it's going to impact us. At the end of the day, the money in your account, that's the measurement.
It's kind of like in and out.
Yeah. After all the fees, did my plan work?
Yeah.
That's the single biggest question. Yes, being fee aware is savvy.
Mm-hmm.
But being fee averse may not be. Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. So that's what I would caution is, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater on this stuff. Know what you're really paying for.
So if someone calls Little John Financial and David Little John happens to answer the phone and they ask about fees, will you be able to make it transparent and easy for them to understand?
I will ask them questions to get to transparency.
Perfect.
Because your circumstance is going to be uniquely yours, and we have to figure out all the things that you're trying
to
do.
So once you figure out what they're looking for, you can present to them something that's really pretty easy to understand.
Yes.
I love it.
All right.
Okay.
Music's
How
playing.
Do they get a hold
we got
to
run. Yep. 541-375-0898. So until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
I'm still Dave Littlejohn. And we'll catch you next time. You've been listening to True Wealth. Have a great one, everyone.